one in. Evening. Hi. I gotta come in.
That's a good one.
Let me, at the beginning, point you to chapter 6. Next week, we will be working in chapter 6. We'll cover the first half down to verse number 18. If you want to do some advanced reading, chapter 6, verse 18. We're kind of getting ready to hit the home stretch, and I think we'll actually get to have an unbroken series of five whole classes without interruption, in which time we will finish the Sermon on the Mount one way or the other. So anyway, that's our portion for next week. Back up to chapter 5, and we're going to finish up. That's a horrifically optimistic statement. Chapter 5 tonight. I think it's the most difficult part of the sermon. Though I don't think it has to be. I think that we've made it difficult usually by not understanding the context or acknowledging the context of some of these statements that sometimes throw us for a loop. So I want to grab, John, kind of wave at me if I start getting redundant with what you said while I was gone. I want to grab the last thing John was talking to you about, 2 weeks ago? Is that right? Chapter 5 and verse 20. Where Jesus says that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Did y'all discuss what a radical statement that was? Why are y'all staring blankly at me? Were y'all here 2 weeks ago? I was in San Diego 2 weeks ago, so no, I have no idea whether y'all said that or not. Why would that be such a radical thing for Jesus to say? Yes. Not by us. Someone says Pharisee, first word that comes into your mind. Yes. We don't think of them as righteous people. We think of them as bad guys in the Bible story. That is not the way that a regular member of the Jewish community would have seen them. They would have been the super spiritual, the ones that everybody else longed to measure up to. And so when he says your righteousness has to be greater than theirs, it was shocking to the audience, and I think even sometimes misunderstood by us as well. So let's just play around with that a little bit. What does he mean when he says our righteousness must surpass theirs? You have a thought about that?
It has to be from the heart. I mean, they were outside people doing outside things to impress other people. And he's saying no. That's the rest of this thing, is all this stuff that comes from the heart. And if your heart's right,
So John uses the words outside and inside, and I think that is precisely the problem. The righteousness of the Pharisees was an outer righteousness. They would appear on the surface to be very pious, but what was missing was the heart. They didn't really have a heart devoted to pleasing God, which is why they sometimes did really, really bizarre things like tie their spices and rip off widows. You know, go read Matthew 23. How could that be? Well, Jesus says that's because they're like a whitewashed tomb. They're real pretty on the outside and got a bunch of corrupt stuff on the inside. That was the problem. And so I think John is exactly right that if you try to outwardly check the boxes but inwardly aren't devoted, then you wind up with all these bizarre contradictions. By contrast, if you are inwardly devoted to God, what happens to the outside? naturally takes care of itself. And so if we make religion about checking boxes, especially our selected boxes that we decide are important, then we're going to get into trouble. If inwardly we will devote ourselves to God, the obedience has a way of taking care of itself. So don't hear in that any kind of minimizing of obedience. Because Jesus talks in the sermon about obedience. Don't lust. Don't divorce. Love your enemies. It's there. It's very specific. But I think the righteousness as he's looking for is something that flows out of a heart devoted to Jesus rather than just outward rule keeping. Does that make sense? Y'all follow that? So I needed to go back over that, not because I had any doubt about the outstanding job John did covering this, but because that is the next segment. He will build on that from verse 20 to give us six examples of where the law has been misunderstood. And I think if we dig into the examples, what he's really saying is, here are six ways that the heart hasn't been there. And it's led to misunderstanding and sometimes even bizarre behavior. And so they're examples of this higher righteousness. Understand, he's not saying you need to check the box better than the Pharisees. I think what he's saying is you need a whole different way of looking at serving God that begins with a heart devoted to him that works its way out into obedience. And so I want us to walk through these six examples he gives us tonight. I will tell you that this is a segment loaded with pitfalls. This is like hiking a trail that has like four or five little side trails that you can take all of the time. And what happens in Arizona, if you get off on a side trail that you weren't planning to take, you die in the desert, okay? Especially this time of year. This comes from very practical experience 2 weeks ago, I'm telling you. If you get off on the side trail, you're going to die in the desert. We are not going to die in the desert in class, okay? We're even going to talk about divorce tonight, and we're going to move past all that really quickly. Because first, I want us to stay with the sermon and not our side curiosities and quibbles. And secondly, I want us to see the point that Jesus is making in this part of the sermon. And I'm afraid, you know, if we get off on these side things that are interesting to us, we'll miss that. And I don't want us to do that. So here's my promise to you. If you are curious, for example, about this little divorce segment and want to pursue that in more detail, I won't let you do it over the next 40 minutes, but I'll do it as long as you want to after class tonight or some other time, okay? Promise you that. For now, I want us to really stay on topic, and I will frame that up by giving you two questions tonight. We're going to reach each segment, and as I read the segment, the question I want you to ponder is, what is the misunderstanding that Jesus is correcting? Because I think with each of his six topics, he is tapping into some way that they've misunderstood this. And I'll give you a hint. It has to do with the heart. Convinced of that. Okay, we'll see if we can find that out as we go through that. So I'm going to read, you're going to look for what is the misunderstanding, and then how does he clear that up? What does he say about it? What is his will in that regard? So, first topic, murder and insults. That's an interesting combo, right? What does he say about murder and insults? This is verse 21. Following right after, you got to have this higher righteousness. Verse 21, he says, you've heard that the ancients were told, you shall not commit murder, and whoever commits murder shall be liable to the court. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court, and whoever says to his brother, you good for nothing, you shall be guilty before the Supreme Court, and whoever says, you fool, shall be guilty enough to go into to the fiery hell. Therefore, if you are presenting your offering at the altar, remember that your brother has something against you, leave your offering there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother and then come and present your offering. Make friends quickly with your opponent at law while you are still on the way so that your opponent may not hand you over to the judge and the judge to the officer and you will be thrown into prison. Truly, I say to you, you will not come out until you have paid up the last cent. So, question number one. What is the misunderstanding? Sometimes to get it, you have to blend what they were told and what Jesus said to figure out what he's tackling here. So what do you think? What's the misunderstanding?
My guess is that for generations they've been led and told more of a legalistic or outside, as you termed it, attitude towards the Word of God. And so my guess is, only a guess, is that a lot of those people have been so influenced by that only that Jesus needs to nail down that, no, this is much more than that. This is a relationship and matters of the heart, and the outside is no good at all without all the inside.
So what is the matter of the heart here?
Forgiveness.
Okay.
Maybe I missed it. You can correct me.
Okay.
That's what it seemed like to me, that all of this was like, you know, well, he says don't murder, you know, they said don't murder, but it's about, you know, don't harbor that anger in your heart.
Okay, all right. That's, let's think about that right there.
Like I said, it's okay to be angry, but just don't murder.
Okay. Okay. That's, I think, what's going on here. The ancients had always been told, do not commit murder. If you do, you're going to be taken before the court. Is that true? Well, then what's he correcting?
Don't let it get that far.
Yeah. There is the problem. Again, we're just dealing with the outside behavior. Don't kill people. Yeah. So why do people kill people? So inside there's a heart issue going on, right? What are the heart issues that lead to murder? Anger, out of control,
jealousy,
frustration,
hurt,
payback, revenge. Yeah, we'll get to that one a little later. Crazy,
money,
greed, hatred, bitterness. Yeah, the crime of murder is rooted in a corrupt heart that's filled with those kinds of things. Here's the interesting thing. Jesus talks about murder in 21, but then what does he talk about in 22? Not anger. Insults. So notice that. Notice the switch between murder and insults. Why does he go from talking about killing people to insulting people?
It's on the path.
All comes from the same heart, doesn't it? Why do people say ugly things about others? What heart conditions motivate or drive people to say ugly and insulting things? Everything we just mentioned, hatred, bitterness, anger out of control, it's all driven by the same heart conditions. And so what is the point Jesus is making here?
I think they thought that they had a right to be angry. They had a right they could get away with murder, but you know what I mean? Evidently they've been taught about behavior so much that they left the heart alone, so about a consistent character trait
that has all kinds
inside.
Of look, all kinds of ugly things come from what is on the inside. Hatred, bitterness, anger that is out of control. Yeah, well, no, don't kill people, but the problem is the way they traditionally understood that is it didn't go far enough. Jesus said, isn't it enough for you not to kill people? I don't want you saying insulting things to people. In fact, bigger than that, I don't want you to have in your heart what produces all of that.
Well, that's understood the second commandment is
your neighbor as yourself.
Then you would have understood that it's not just about murder. That's one aspect of loving your neighbor, but it's much broader and bigger than that.
In fact, where is he going to end? What is the sixth? You have heard, but I say. Love your neighbor and hate your enemies. But I say to you, right? Love your enemies. That's the crowning point at the end of it. So I think the point Jesus is making here is the bigger issue in all of this, whether it's murder or insults, is the corrupt heart. And so what does he say to do about that? How soon? How immediate?
Even before you sacrifice to God.
If you are at church, leave. Listen. Understand the point he's making. He chooses such an important event because he's trying to emphasize the importance of immediacy. By the way, it's not the only time you see that in Scripture. Remember in Ephesians 4, 26 and 27? Be angry and yet do not sin. What's the rest of it? Do not let the sun go down on your anger. What's the idea? Again and again, Scripture's telling us you got to let go of that anger quickly before it gets you into trouble, which is why if you're going to law with someone, dude, you better take care of that. Again, the idea of urgency and immediacy. Don't hang on to that or it's going to get you into trouble. So do you see the point? Do you see the higher righteousness? It's not about, hey, just don't go kill your neighbor. Jesus said, no. Don't harbor the kind of feelings and character that produce that kind of behavior. You've got to address that in the heart. Does that make sense? Yeah, John. Right. What is the Romans 12 standard? As far as depends on you, that is exactly right. Don't you ever be the liability to reconciliation. There is something you can do, no matter which side of this you're on, offender or offendee, you be the one to fix it. Why? Because out of bitterness and anger and hatred stored in the heart just comes a whole tree of evil fruit, to borrow from VBS last week.
You don't even want to be the cause of somebody else.
Correct.
You're causing them to be just as, might as well have been a murderer.
Yep. So do we need this? What is this assault in our life? Did that make sense? Was that even a good question?
Well, verse 22. You good for nothing. You fool. You idiot.
I think this should make us really uncomfortable, not just with the wicked actions that are less than murder, which is what the Lord is saying. He goes from murder to insults. Why? Because it's all wicked. But even with the harboring in the heart, I think sometimes we're just like the people Jesus is admonishing here. We're thinking, well, as long as I'm not mean, I'm okay, right? And what's the standard biblically? Don't have it in your heart. Don't harbor it in your heart. You have to let it go, right? Wow, what a tall order. Righteousness that exceeds the righteousness of the Pharisees. That's the call. All right, 27, let's press on. Do you see how the principle is working here? How the righteousness of kingdom dwellers surpasses the righteousness of the Pharisees. They are not content to check the boxes and to line up their outward behavior. They understand that true devotion to God grows from the inside out into the life. Okay, so 27. You've heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out and throw it from you, for it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. If your right hand makes you stumble, cut it off and throw it from you, for it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. So my question is, what is the misunderstanding he is correcting here? Okay. The law said, you shall not commit adultery. Is that true? Yes. So what's the problem? They were saying what was true.
You need to remain pure.
Does it go far enough? Yeah, it's true as far as it goes, but again, where does adultery come from? The lust that is in the heart. So I actually think somewhere in my notes, what I wrote down, Troy, was Jesus moves the line in the way people typically think about sexual sin. Even us too, right? So as long as I don't act on it, right? No harm, no foul. And I think that's the kind of thinking that had taken over. The problem is the sex act, committing adultery. As long as you don't do that, well, then there's no violation of the law. What's Jesus saying about that? The vast majority of time, adultery is a process sin. You know what I mean when I say that? What does that mean? To say adultery is a process sin. Yeah. It doesn't begin with, oh my, I find myself here at the door of a hotel room with a woman I'm not married to. That is not the way that happens, right? There's a whole lot of thinking and plotting and words. All that kind of stuff leads to it. And what Jesus is saying is, where that becomes sin is when? Yeah, all the way at the beginning of the process. Listen, if Jesus isn't happy where the end of the road leads, or the end of the road, he's not happy about the stuff that gets us there. See what he's saying? So what leads to adultery? Lust. Where do we fight this battle? You see? You got to come back to the inside and address the things that are in the heart. Yep.
So how do I know where the line is between temptation and lust?
What is the difference between temptation and lust? I'm not sure I know how to make that distinction.
Well, Christ was tempted as we were.
Yes.
So it wouldn't be surprising, technically, if he was felt some kind of physical reactions for the form of a woman. But it wouldn't have been lust. It couldn't have been.
Yeah, so the better question for me is not to distinguish between temptation and lust, but to ask when is that line crossed? Because is it possible? I feel that I'm wandering down a path. It's possible for a man to admire a woman's beauty and that not be lust, correct?
Sure.
Okay. Right.
Tempted.
Right.
And that can't be true.
Yeah.
Because Jesus was tempted.
So I think about David on the rooftop.
Needed to go down.
Yeah.
You see it, go down.
Yes.
Get off your rooftop.
Yeah. Well, he sees.
It's a conscious act of will to.
Was it a sin to see? Oh boy, that was a bad question. Let me just say it. It wasn't a sin to see. Accidents happen, that's what I believe, and we won't go any further down that road. When did it become sin for him?
When he lusted in his heart.
Yes, when he took, well, first of all, he kept looking. Yes. And then there's mental processes going on, and I'm not going to say much more about that, that become the sin. So to me, it's not that he saw. It's not that a man looks and admires a woman's beauty. It's what happens after that. Yeah, heart action, though, yes. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Decision in his head.
Right. That's exactly right. So actually, I mean, there's a really great point to be made there about this idea of taking every thought captive and recognizing what a slippery slope this is, especially for the guys. And so the need, when that moment presents itself, to really put that to a stop and stop it quickly. In fact, look at the next two verses. What does Jesus say about addressing this? Sorry?
Do whatever it takes to avoid it. Cut off your hand.
He says, pluck your eyes out. Really? What do we do with that? Well, I will tell you, I don't think that he's arguing for mutilation of the body to tame our passions because it wouldn't work. You can pluck out your right eye, it's still left with less with your left one, right? That's all the problem. You can pluck both of them out and still retrieve images that have been filed away mentally, and a blind man can still lust if he's had an opportunity to see things that he couldn't see. It doesn't solve the problem. And I think what you said first, actually, is exactly right. I think what he's saying is you got to do whatever it takes to bring your passions under control and to subdue your lust. That's interesting, the things he chooses here for his examples. I think he's addressing one of the most powerful struggles that men face. So what's that in that for me and you? What's our takeaway from that? Kingdom citizens today. Well, first of all, our standard has to be higher than our culture, because I think our culture would say there's no problem with looking as long as you don't act on it. In fact, that's legally kind of where we draw the line, right? You can think about anything you want to as long as it doesn't work itself out into your actions, which is sort of bizarre thinking anyway, clearly. But the Lord said, I don't even want this in you. I don't want the things that produce the fruit growing in your heart. And so I think there is an obligation, especially in this culture where there's so many opportunities to look and lust, to really take our thoughts captive and to recognize that danger and to acknowledge that I can't do that, to look at lust as sin, whether I act on it or not, right? Especially in our culture. And that perhaps that will require radical actions. I've encountered some guys that I've said, you need to get a dumb phone. A phone that calls people, but you can't get online with. I don't think that's necessarily what's required for every man who struggles with porn. But frankly, there are some men that nothing else works. And if nothing else is working, listen, what does Jesus say is at stake here? He said, you're going to go to hell. And so how important is it to do whatever I have to do to deal with it? So my goodness, I can live without a cell phone that doesn't update me on the Astros, who won, by the way, just thought I'd throw that in. But I can't live with lust in my heart, right? Serious business to the Lord. All right, 31. What's next? Whoever sends away his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, except for the reason of unchastity, unchastity makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. So, what misunderstanding is Jesus correcting? Wow, so I did some reading about this and actually took great consolation knowing that they struggled with the divorce issue as much as we do. And essentially, you had a whole rainbow of different ideas about this. From one extreme, the school of Hillel that said, you don't like her and want a younger one? Fine, divorce her, give her a certificate. And on the other extreme, the school of Shammai that said, only in cases of adultery do you have a right to put her away. And so you can just imagine that they heard all kinds of different ideas and teaching about that. I will tell you that my view of this text has, I guess I would describe it as pretty traditional. I think when people get married, God wants them to stay together for a lifetime. I think that's the original intent for marriage. And when people ignore that and they divorce, they sin. And when they divorce and marry someone else, they involve themselves in adulterous relationships. And that the only exception to that is when there is unfaithfulness. One of the reasons I'm inclined that way, because it agrees with God's original plan for marriage, that a man and a woman would spend a lifetime together. Matthew 19:6, what God has joined together, let no man separate. And so I think God, about marriage, wants our heart to agree with his heart, that we're in this for life together. And I will just tell you, because of that, when someone comes along and advocates a position, I was literally on the phone with someone a month ago who was explaining to me a new way to understand Scripture. And when he finished, I said, you do realize that essentially would say God is okay with almost every divorce. And I just got to tell you, when someone finds a new way to understand Scripture that says that, I am suspicious, because that seems completely counter to God's original plan for this, for two people to spend their lifetime together. And bearing in mind that he's calling us here to a higher standard. Isn't it an odd thing that when someone has figured out a new angle on this, it always is more permissive for divorce? I've never heard someone say, you know, I've got another interpretation that really tightens this up and makes it even more restrictive. Why do you think we're so inclined to have new views come along that relax the standard on divorce? It's hard. What about the world we live in?
They accept
divorce. We live in a culture where basically 4 out of 10 first marriages are going to break up along the way somewhere. So it's just common. And so I'm suspicious as well when that's the way culture is going, that some way we're finding a way to make it okay in the culture. And it seems to me that God had an original plan, and he calls us to that higher standard no matter what's going on in our culture. So I think we need to be suspicious and cautious about that. I think there's a danger of getting swept away with culture. I think there's a danger of wanting to accommodate people who get into messes, and we wind up not putting the line on this where Jesus did. But to come back to what we said originally, what does this have to do with this higher righteousness? I think that disciples need to have in their heart today the same heart about marriage that Jesus did. What was the original plan? What was the idea?
Divorce is not an option. Work out your problems. You're in it together. If you choose her, you made your choice.
One life, one life.
I know there are exceptions biblically. They ought to be the rare thing, not the routine. And that's what's happening in our culture today. So I think that's addressed by having in our heart what was in God's heart. And that is, we're in this for life. We need to stick it out through the tough times all the way to the end. Yes, yes. A bunch of messes, and implicated somebody else when you remarry in the messes. And we know the messes, don't we? We know the people and the hurt and the pain that comes along with this. Yep.
Can you divorce your wife for any reason at all?
And there were people in that culture, rabbis, who were teaching that essentially for any reason at all you can do that. I think that's the misconception that he is correcting here, and correcting it by going back to what I think was God's original purpose and plan. Okay, 33. How much time do I have? Okay. We're doing way better than I thought we would. 33 deals with vows. Again, you have heard the ancients were told, you shall not make false vows, but shall fulfill your vows to the Lord. But I say to you, make no vow at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is the footstool of his feet, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Nor shall you make an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black, but let your statement be yes, yes, or no, no. Anything beyond these is of evil. So question, what is the misunderstanding that he is correcting here? Can you see it? First of all, what they had been taught, was that true? Make no false vows, right? Fulfill your vows. That was true. The law required that. What's the misunderstanding?
That actually making a vow adds anything to your yea or your nay.
It does. Let me ask you a different way. Any clue on how they may have been corrupting this? Yeah, look at 33, when he quotes, but you shall fulfill your vows, what's the rest? To the Lord. So, if you were making a promise, ending with someone without the intention of honoring it, if you were being dishonest, lying, then when it came time to pay the vow, now you're looking for a loophole. And here was one of the loopholes lately. If you make your vow to the Lord, you must fulfill it. So if you invoked the name of God, you had to keep that vow. But if you did not invoke the name of God, then you weren't required to keep the vow. You could get a pass on that, or you could find a way out. What do you think about that? Huh? Good. That's exactly what it is. It's good lawyering. It's looking for a loophole in the language. Question, what does it say about the heart?
I wasn't willing to fulfill the whole oath in the first place.
I lied when I started this. I was being dishonest at the beginning. And so, yeah. So the inside was corrupt. You're not honorable on the inside. What are you? You're a liar. You're dishonest. You're promising something you don't intend to keep. There's a heart issue that is involved there. And I think the point Jesus makes is, look, if you are the kind of person I called you to be, you shouldn't even have to make a vow. Why? Because I honor my word because I'm a follower of Jesus and he teaches me to be honest and a person of integrity. I think the most important passage in this whole little segment is verse 37. He just said, listen, let your yes be yes and your no be no. Mean what you say. Keep your word is the point that Jesus is making here. In fact, I thought it's kind of interesting that over the years, I remember as a young kid growing up in the church that brethren used to argue a lot about whether or not you could swear in court. Because Jesus said, make no vow. And so all I can tell you about that is it just completely misses the point of the text, okay? Because the truth is, guys, we make vows all the time. I promise I will be there Saturday to help you. That's a vow. That's a promise.
You make a vow to your wife when you get
You get the vow to your wife when you get married. You promise when you sign the contract that I will make payments all the way until the end of this contract and the house is paid for, right? We make vows and promises all the time. That is not what the Lord is talking about here. The Lord is talking about people who, out of the dishonesty that's in their heart, would go into a contract intending not to keep it and then trying to find a loophole to get out of it. He says, that is not the people that you ought to be. And if you had the right heart on the inside, you wouldn't have this bad behavior coming out on the outside. You see the point? So he's calling us to a higher standard. The Pharisees, they were looking for a loophole. How can I get out of my vow? When Jesus said, you ought to be concerned with how you're going to keep it. Does that make sense? Heart of the problem every time. Okay, 38. I've been wanting to get here. Oh, boy. Okay. 7 minutes. 38 to 42, I think, has just tripped a lot of people up, and hopefully we can eliminate some of that with this last segment. 38, you've heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist the evil person. But whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. If anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, let him have your coat also. Whoever forces you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to him who asks. Do not turn away from him who wants to borrow from you. So, wow. What do you do with that? What's the misunderstanding he's trying to correct here? Any ideas about that? Yeah, I'd sit quietly where you are if I was sitting down in class too.
Well, if I could Americanize it, he said, you've heard it say, don't get mad, get even. So,
well, start at the beginning with 38. You've heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and the tooth for a tooth. Where does that come from? It comes from the Old Testament. That was actually there in the law. But here's the problem. And the passages where that language is used, well, let me ask you and see if you know. What purpose did the principle serve? Why did God give that principle in the Old Testament? To
the first person, don't. I mean, it's a deterrent to both. I'm, you know, don't do this because this is what's going to happen to you. Well, if I don't want to lose a tooth, I'm not going to take somebody else's.
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying. It was a principle that God gave them to help them judge how they would punish crime, right? And so, you and I understand when there is a terrible injustice, what do we want to do with the punishment? When someone's done a horrible thing, oh man, we want to drop the hammer on them. And so this principle is designed exactly to deal with that. Punishments were not meant to be meted out in anger, but in fairness. And so in the old law, a punishment could not be excessive. It had to be appropriate to the crime that was committed. And so that was the principle. You can back read, there are about three passages where this language is used. Now, here's the point. This was a principle to be sure they didn't go too far when punishing crimes. What the Pharisees are doing with this is they are co-opting it and using it to justify personal vengeance. So if you mistreat me, I can really stick it to you and get even with you. Do you see the problem? They're using that Old Testament principle in a way that God never intended. So what is the principle? How are we to treat personal offenses?
Love your neighbor.
Sorry? Love your neighbor. That's the last principle. What else? Don't ever fight back. I have no idea why you said that, except my wife's making trouble. What did Paul say in Romans? Never do what? Romans 12. Never return evil for evil. Never, Romans 12, remember this? Never seek your own revenge, but leave room for what? Yeah, leave room for the wrath of God, for vengeance is mine, I will repay. What else does he say there about your enemies? I should have read this. Love your enemies. Yes, pray for those who persecute. That is exactly right. And so the principle is, Christians don't take personal vengeance against people who mistreat them. And so what he does is he gives us these examples. It's the examples that are the problem, right? So someone comes up and starts wailing away at you, you're just supposed to take it, right? What's he saying when he says, turn the other cheek? Yeah, we misunderstand that. This is not someone going and wailing away on you, right? This is a personal insult. And in that culture, one way you did that was by slapping your hand across the face, right? And what's Jesus saying about that? Yeah, don't get even. Take it. Yeah, that's exactly right. Someone takes you to court and tries to sue you unfairly. He says it's better to lose your shirt than to behave like your opponent. Does that mean I can't hire a lawyer to defend myself? No, that's not what the Lord's saying at all. He's saying you don't take personal vengeance to your enemy. You don't let your enemy pull you down to your level. In fact, what if it should be that someone who has been unkind to you later on needs your help? What are you supposed to do? Yeah, you're supposed to help. Show mercy. Well, yeah. And so here's the beauty of it, guys. This is Jesus. He is the one who paved the way on loving your enemies. By the way, if we're running out of time, there's your number six example. You've heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. What did the Lord say about that? Yeah, exactly right. And so in this Rambo culture in which we live, where it's all about evening the score, Jesus is saying, accept the insult. Someone insults you, what do?
Say something nice.
Be kind to them. Someone who's mistreated you is in need. Return their evil with good, right? We need to be so careful. We need to be cautious that we're not so careful to sort of say what he's not saying that we forget what he is saying. And that is, I don't have a right to mistreat the person who treats me worse than anyone else. My obligation is the same, to overcome evil with good. I think what is being taught here is difficult and counter-cultural. Begins with a heart. What would be the inside character piece that enables us to do that? Oh. Remembering what's been done for us. Good. What else? What's the last principle?
Love.
Who?
Love your enemies. People who don't. Well, if you start by loving God, because he's loved us, then yeah. It's easy to love
everyone else. Yeah. Jesus, in the last part of the chapter, says, like me, you need to love your enemies. You need to be like God and love your enemies. And if that's what's in my heart, then things like vengeance, even when provoked, mistreating even someone who's mistreated you, there's no room for that, because that's not who we are in our character. And I think it's interesting that he ends here, because it's the toughest part, right? But you are correct. He already blazed that trail for us. While we were enemies, Christ died for us. So I blaze the trail, you be like me. I think we're going to work some more on this higher in chapter 6. So I invite you to think about that as we look at those first 18 verses next time we're together. We're out of time. Thank y'all for giving me a couple of extra minutes. I appreciate that.